Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
We may be a year away from the next federal election, but there is growing talk the environment may once again be a key issue as politicians try to sway your vote. To discuss where the parties stand and where the debate is headed, we're joined by the former president of the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy.
There's been a huge jump in complaints about access to information with the federal government. Information Commissioner Suzanne Legault is here to break down the numbers and explain why there are so many issues getting data from the feds.
After more than 50 years of work, it's now on the record. The Library of Parliament has finished a massive project to piece together the debates for the first several years Canada was a country. We find out what was said between our first MPs as they began to build our nation.
And we'll fast forward to find out what is wrong with Parliament today and how the House of Commons can be fixed. More than 80 former members of Parliament weigh in the book Tragedy in the Commons. To talk more about it, we're joined by the author and co-founder of Samara, Alison Lote.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Ahead of the 2015 federal election, both the general concern about climate change and Canada's commitment to the Copenhagen Accord on greenhouse gas reductions are looming over Canadian politics and the three major parties. So where does that leave the environmental debate in this country?
David McLaughlin is the former president of the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy. Before that, he was an advisor to governments at the provincial and federal level and served as chief of staff to the late finance minister, Jim Flaherty. David and I sat down to take stock of where the parties stand and discuss where the debate might go ahead of 2015.
I guess, first of all, where's the environment debate now and where's it going sort of in the next year?
We don't know where it is exactly going. I don't believe the parties themselves, any of the three parties, except for the Green Party perhaps, really knows where they want to go on this. And it's because the last 4 years we've seen a particularly sharp cleavage in partisan opinion on files of climate and resource development, with the Conservatives with their majority hoping to use that to push pipeline projects through, finding that it's easier said than done, despite some streamlining of the environmental process rules, and getting pushback now from two new leaders, of course, Thomas Mulcair for the NDP and Justin Trudeau for the Liberals. Both of those parties are struggling to clearly define themselves in a politically acceptable way on climate and pipeline. So you've got the NDP more into a sort of a no to development, except we have an Energy East pipeline that is pan-Canadian, and he kind of likes that. We have Justin Trudeau saying yes to Keystone, but no to, which is the pipeline to the United States, but no to Northern Gateway, which is pipeline from Alberta through to BC. And then, of course, on Energy East, again, pan-Canadian, that's okay. So if you're in the pipeline environmental business, clearly a pan-Canadian pipeline, has more support. But it really does show the conundrum and the dilemma the parties are in. The Conservatives have still been pretty successful, I think, at framing it as a jobs and economic development issue. And I think, as some commentators have written, if they can grab that part of the vote, that suits their political purposes more. So I don't think we're seeing any really effective longer-term positioning on this that'll help us deal with the integration of an energy, environment, and economy. It's really the next year that is driving, I think, the debate here, at least politically, within the country.
So where the Conservatives have gone a couple ways on this. They have, in the past, argued for cap and trade. Then they backed off of that. They now attack cap and trade. They have promised regulations for the oil and gas sector. They've backed off of that. They now say they want to work in concert with the United States. It's not clear where that's going. How far do you think they can take it? Can they go into 2015 without some concrete plan to regulate the oil and gas sector?
I think we may just find out, because there's nothing on the radar screen for the, as you point out, Aaron, that shows that they're ready to go on this. Oil and gas regulations have been promised for some time. As you say, they have punted on it in part because the U.S. was, for a while in the Obama administration, was really trying to figure its way out. The pressure from the global climate conversations had diminished. It wasn't all that strong. And yet the government keeps talking about we're going to do something on this, but every time it actually comes to a time frame, they seem to then push it further. I think they are still trying to figure out politically what to do with this. And that may seem trite, except that it seems to be the thing that has really been driving their climate policy of late. We know from all of the – despite having an initial push to do something on climate and having a plan, turning the corner plan, having, as you said, looked at putting in cap and trade, they have been walking back from any serious new measures beyond some of the coal-fired electricity plant measures that they've put in place, which affect future plants, some alignment measures on autos and trucks with the U.S. They're fine, but they do not get us anywhere near our 2020 climate target. So the Harper government is certainly not seized with the issue in an extensive policy way to try to get this done and putting, you know, new measures on the books, rallying the private sector, provinces and others to say, look, we as a country have to meet the 2020 target and what are we going to do on it? So I would not be surprised to see the oil and gas reg still just kind of hanging out there. And the evidence of that, to the extent that we can actually point to something concretely, is that we now hear more and more the Harper government talking about the need to align with the United States on this measure. And that was never really the case before. So I think the government's going to just kind of keep this in the fray for a little bit. And try to find a political way out of it in terms of the election, hoping that either Trudeau or Mulcair will give them something to attack them with, going back to the politics of we're pro-development and pro-growth and you're not.
Well, that's the other flip side of this is, you know, so the Conservatives don't seem to quite have an offer at this point on the environment file, except to talk about what they've done otherwise without touching oil and gas. The Liberals and the NDP... You know, the NDP will offer cap and trade, it seems. The Liberals have talked sort of loosely about a price on carbon. They haven't quite specified. Can either of those parties, is that a winning hand for either of those parties to be saying, we're going to put a price on carbon, it's going to cost this much? You know, it gets brought up, it's maybe a bit trite, but the 2008 example of Stéphane Dion on the carbon tax, that has been pinned on that loss. You know, are they just setting themselves up to lose in 2015 if they're offering a big price on carbon?
I think offering a carbon price that you can put a number on is still a big political risk in the country, and that is where we are as a result of Stéphane Dion's Green Shift and the successful Conservative campaign at the time. So in many ways, that's really been taken off the table as a solution, if you will, to resolving climate change and starting to get our emissions down. But there's and so both the Liberals and the NDP are going to have to watch that and try to avoid very much allowing the Conservatives to kind of demonize them into that. The problem is, and this is where the Conservatives have probably a smile on their face, is that if they want to do more on climate and carbon, then we have to have some form of carbon pricing. The reason the Conservatives have gone for the regulation approach, sector by sector, is that there's no government price. The price is buried. It's caught up in the fine print. Nobody can actually point to it, as opposed to a $15 tax or a $20 tax or what have you. So the Conservatives have gone too far on a tax on everything, job-killing carbon tax, to just drop that. And I think they will continue to try to label the other parties with it. So I can see that still remaining as a wedge issue.
How there seems to be this idea that kind of gets thrown around that we're heading towards a big reckoning on this issue. That, you know, weather will get bad, and that may move public opinion, or maybe public opinion's already moving. Or, you know, periodically people, I think, try to find kind of glimmers of light here that are, you know, going to point us in the right direction on this debate. Do you see that coming? Like, do you see the public being more interested in the environment than it maybe was 5 or 10 years ago? Like, do you see some point at which the public becomes ready to pay the cost that seems to be necessary to meet the global and national GHG targets that we apparently need to hit?
You fingered exactly the right problem here. It's, you pointed it. Until the public gets seized in a way on this issue, the politicians are still going to be fearful of treading too far. And this is the political dialectic. The climate cycle doesn't fit the electoral cycle. You know, we're talking generation 50, 100 years of climate cycles that we're now into, an electoral cycle of 4 years. So who wants to give up, you know, votes now for potential votes later when you may not even be alive, let alone in office? But I am sensing, and I'm seeing increasing evidence from business community, I'm sensing from the public and seeing increasing evidence from the business community that that people are paying more attention. Superstorm Sandy in the United States has certainly gotten attention. The fact that the Obama administration, in the last 2 years of his term, is forcing action on this and raising the bar on it, he clearly sees that as a legacy issue. Well, that's obviously very very helpful, and we're seeing evidence of climate impacts more and more. Floods in Calgary, Toronto. While you can't always say that they are absolutely directly linked to climate change, the climate impacts that we're having and are projected to have are erratic, extreme weather events. So you can't, they're not going to happen in an absolute linear, direct fashion. What may be happening 1 year may not happen for two more years. But the fact that we're getting, 100-year floods in a much shorter time frame should concentrate the mind. So yes, when people, as human beings, when we see something, we think it's real. When we hear something directly, we think it's real. We react to those kinds of stimuli. And obviously, if we have increasing physical evidence of climate change and extreme weather impacts, people are going to make these links, and they will demand, as I think we're seeing more and more, but not yet at a tipping point, people doing that. Business community are obviously getting pressure from investors. Reputationally, from investment funds, their corporate social responsibility obligations, they're putting more attention on that. We're getting, some of the fossil fuel divestment stuff is, it's happening out there. I wouldn't say it's a big push right now, but if we're a fossil fuel economy and in many ways relying on fossil fuel growth to drive the Canadian economy in its immediate growth projections, we got to pay attention to this for some of the longer term. So it takes us back to the economic linkages on the environment. So, I think it's starting to pick up. I think it's notable that Ontario, with a new government, has appointed a minister of environment and climate change in one department. So it's the second province now. Ontario and Quebec, so our two largest provinces, are heading down that path. So, perhaps the beginning of a political consensus. It's real, but it's happening in an incremental way.
That was David McLaughlin, the former president of the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy.
Every year, Canada's Information Commissioner releases a report on the general access Canadians have to info they want from the federal government. And this year, there are some big problems. Commissioner Suzanne Legault finds that complaints about the government refusing to release documents under the Access to Information Act are up an eye-popping 30%.
Most of the logjam results from a combination of a big demand for info and the reluctance of the government to provide it. Legault spoke with McLean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes about her report.
Why are complaints up so much? 30% seems like a lot.
Well, there's been an increasing number of requests overall in the system as well. So two years ago, 2013, we saw an increase of 27%, close to 28% increase in requests overall in the system. So we do have a corresponding increase, a slightly more increase in complaints in our office.
Is it, I can think of two broad ways to discuss this. One is to wonder whether or not there aren't enough resources in the system to administer and deal with all the requests there are for information under the Act. And the other is that officials in control of information are more reluctant to release it. Do you think it's a mix of those two, or do you put more of the burden of blame in one area or the other?
We have a real mix. We have some institutions like Citizenship and Immigration Canada, which basically carries the government's statistical performance, doing very well in absorbing this increase.
They respond quickly and efficiently.
Yes, but also their requests are more routine, and they don't have a lot of pages. On the flip side, you have other institutions like the RCMP or Transport Canada who actually did not handle the year well at all. And so you have some institutions that really have very high high levels of difficulty for different reasons. At Transport Canada, it was really the surge in response to the number of requests dealing with the Lac-Mégantic tragedy.
I see.
And at the RCMP, it was more in terms of the resources levels in the RCMP at the time. So two very different reasons. Both institutions are addressing it now, but we had, during that year, a very mixed performance overall.
Could I ask about one area or one group of areas, the national security, defense, international affairs cluster, where I know there are a lot of complaints. In that area, is there just a sort of a clash between the demands or the sense in people, that is, the minds of people making requests that they should be able to get information, and a strong culture of secrecy in those parts of government?
They are highly sensitive files. Everyone, including investigators in my office, are extremely cautious in handling these files, in reviewing these files, and in applying the exemptions under the Act. And I think that that's fair. There has to be a very serious scrutiny and a proper balance given to the national security files, because there is an interest in protecting some security-related information, and there is an interest in ensuring that the information that should be disclosed is disclosed. So it's a very fine balance. I think that there is probably, following the Snowden revelations, a very strong push towards more transparency in security-related files. And in fact, this year, there have been some releases of information that I think we would not have seen before.
Interesting.
So there is a movement going on in terms of transparency related to national security, but we have had a significant increase in requests on those files this year.
As a journalist, I've run into the cabinet confidence exclusion quite often. I know that's an area you flagged before. Can you tell me the state of your thinking on that? How should that rule be changed? It's the rule that prevents or allows information to be withheld if it's basically gone to cabinet.
The main problem that I have with cabinet confidences is not that they would be protected under the Act. I think that that's perfectly legitimate. I think the issue is that if they are protected as an exclusion, they're excluded from the application of the Act, and that's where I really disagree with the way the Act is structured in that respect, because that means I don't have the ability to review the records.
Which means someone, you have to take someone's word for it. When they say it's cabinet confidence, it's cabinet confidence, whether, and you don't get to check to see whether that holds up.
That's correct.
So in a national security matter, let's say someone says, well, we can't release this, it's a matter of national security, you get to check to see whether that holds up. But if someone says, we were not releasing this because it's a cabinet confidence, in that area, well, that's the end of the line. You don't get to see that and double check someone's thinking on whether something really is a cabinet confidence or not.
That's correct. What we see in terms of cabinet confidences is a description of the records and a schedule.
Could I finally ask about the new strategic plan you have in the works? What do you hope to achieve with that?
We're going to do a big push towards the mediation component. We're going to really try to settle cases at the onset, very quickly, with complainants and institutions.
Sort of step between them and help them work things out rather than having to issue orders, that sort of, or not an order, but issue a finding.
Yeah, really try to tackle the complex cases right away. I'm hopeful that this will allow us to settle matters more quickly to the satisfaction of both the complainants and reduce the burden on institutions.
That was Federal Information Commissioner Suzanne Legault speaking with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes.
Coming up, we look at a major project from the Library of Parliament that pieces together the first debate in the House of Commons, and later we find out what's wrong with Parliament today and how former MPs think it can be fixed. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine. Coming up on the show, we look at what's wrong with the House of Commons today and how former politicians think it can be fixed. But first,
when Canada became a country in 1867, those first MPs and senators on Parliament Hill were building a nation. As they worked hard to construct and shape our home and native land, No one was officially recording their crucial proceedings in these political chambers.
That means there were no transcripts of all the debates, speeches, questions, and answers in those early days. It wasn't until 1871 that the Senate first began the official recordings known as Hansard, and the House of Commons didn't follow suit until 1875. Now, after decades of work, the Library of Parliament has finally pieced together many of those early proceedings in a major project to reconstitute the debates.
Now, Aaron, I had the opportunity to visit the rare book room of the library, which is filled with historic and cultural treasures being kept in a climate-controlled environment two floors underground. Sonia Bebbington, the Director of Knowledge Management and Preservation, was able to show me some of the original papers that they used to restore these deliberations.
So the two papers that got used the most often that we see represented in the scrapbooks are the Ottawa Times and the Toronto Mail.
As we examine the documents, Bebbington even read from some of her favorite reports from the opening of Parliament in 1874.
A wet snow fell from the dawn of day up to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and during that period, clouds of an ominous character hovered immediately above the city. So this is 1874, March 26th. So that's the election of the new speaker. The appearances of excitement increased, and they're talking about they were thronged with people. The bright colors of the garments worn by a considerable number of the fairer sex lent a happy warmth. Meanwhile, a steady stream of people who were fortunate enough to possess tickets of admission to the galleries of the houses poured into the buildings, awaiting in the corridors, while upon the floor of the house were ranged on either side, in company with the Countess of Dufferin, the fairest dames of Ottawa. And this is a rare occasion where you see women represented in these debates. Obviously, at this time period, there were no women representatives in Parliament. So you really only get to see them as ornaments, which is, you know, sort of just an unfortunate reality of that time period.
After that brief tour, Sonia Bebbington and I sat down in the library to speak about the project.
So Sonia, thank you very much for giving me access like this and joining me here today.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure. I love talking about this stuff.
How did this start? How did this project get going?
Well, it actually got started in 1961. So this is a project to reconstruct content representing the debates in the chambers prior to the introduction of an official record. So it was in 1961 that a doctor of history at the University of Saskatchewan, Norman Ward, approached the Speaker of the House of Commons, who was Roland Michener, and said, you know, I've had this idea bumping around for a while. You've got these scrapbook collections of the Parliamentary Press Gallery and the newspaper reports of what was happening in the chambers. Why don't we reconstruct a version of a modern debate, kind of graft that content onto the current format of the debate and fill that gap? So he proposed that in 1961. It was approved as a project for funding in 1962. And I think they believed they could get the whole gap, 1867 to 1874, completed for the centenary in 1967.
And it took a lot longer than that.
We finished it in January this year. So yeah, it took a lot longer than that. It's extremely intensive, labor-intensive work in terms of all of the fact-checking, editing, and then you've got to translate it. And then you've got to index it. And, I mean, you know, it's almost 150 years later. So some of that fact-checking isn't all that easy. We've got the journals of the time that sort of give us a sense of the sort of bullet points of business that each chamber was taking care of. But it really is an intensive process. And now that we're approaching the 150th, we've got it completed. And it's at those moments of reflection, I think, that you want to look back at your origins. And so it's no accident that it started for the centenary. And as we're approaching the 150th, there was really a renewed importance to really complete that gap.
There was a form, a short form of reporting on Parliament during that time, but it wasn't very detailed. How did you get all of the information? What sources did you look at to make sure that you got these debates down as best you could?
So at the time, and they still exist now, are the journals of the Senate and the House of Commons. And the journals really are, like I said, that sort of bullet point representation. So-and-so tabled this paper.
there was debate. So-and-so presented this version of a bill, and there was debate. So you're getting debate continued. You're getting these little in italics, and debate continued. So you have a skeleton of the business that was accomplished at each sitting, but you don't get any sense of that narrative, that debate. So fleshing that out to understand really what was the tone, what were people concerned about when they talked about this bill and they made these amendments, and then you see, you know, that next published version. So we had the journals of the time, and we have the newspaper accounts, so mostly from the Toronto Globe. There's some from the Toronto Mail, and the Ottawa Times are the newspapers.
What are some fascinating things that you may have discovered while going through a lot of the debates?
Well, some of this stuff, As a Hansard geek, I have to say, the debate that I like the best is the debate about the debates. Should we introduce an official record? And there's back and forth. This was referred to a special committee to study the prospect of having an official record. Sir John A. Macdonald was a real proponent. It's too bad that, and Dr. Tupper as well, said something to the effect of that the first few years of this country have passed, and a future historian can't put his hand to an official version of what was happening. So there's some great debate around that. There is Louis Riel was elected in Provence, and did he come? He signed the roll, the registry, but he never actually took his seat in the Commons. So the day around that, so everyone's looking, it says in the debates, everyone's looking expectantly at a seat in the corner held by Provence, and you get a sense of how this palpable excitement in the air to see, is he gonna take his seat? What's going to happen here? There is Thomas Darcy McGee is assassinated, and it's I think it's Sir John A. who stands up and starts addressing the speaker and is overcome with emotion. I think there's partly he's I can actually read you a little excerpt. Yeah, so it's John A. Macdonald. This is April 7th, 1868. And he's saying, amid profound silence and attention, and manifestly struggling to repress extreme emotion, which frequently interrupted his delivery and made him almost inaudible in some passages, rose and said that it was with feelings of pain amounting to anguish that he addressed the chair. And then he goes on to say, Thomas Darcy McGee has passed from among them foully murdered. If ever a soldier who had fallen on the field of battle in the front rank of the fray had deserved well of his country, Thomas Darcy McGee had deserved well of Canada and her people. So you're getting a sense, because in the reconstituted debates, we retain that narrative. It's all we have. Now the Hansard is verbatim, and someone stands and speaks, and you can imagine the inflection. Because we're retaining that third-person narrative, they're telling us the inflection. They're telling us that he was struggling to repress extreme emotion and almost inaudible in some points. So you're that narrative sense is really lending a lot of drama that maybe otherwise wouldn't be there. But, I mean, this is Thomas Darcy McGee. There's some pretty heavy-duty drama going on.
So with this project, you're also getting a sense of how this parliamentary system in this country sort of came to be on those very first days. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
There is a sense of that's happening sort of pre-Confederation, so the Quebec Conference of 1864, and there's a lot of material around that about building the system. What you tend to see in these debates is, okay, now we got the system down, let's build this nation. So there is a real sense of nation building that's happening in the debate. So it would bringing further provinces into Confederation, things like common currency, things like mail service, rail service, having an intercontinental railway, and those things that are nation building. If Speaker Scheer was at our launch event, and in his remarks, he says, through these debates, you can see the map of Canada being drawn, and they're making those decisions that are still with us, and you can sort of see that happening and see the debate around that. For me, like I said, being a Hansard geek, I like the debate about debates. So they're talking about how much it's going to cost, and they made The sessional indemnity for a member was about $600, and there was a committee that estimated it being at least $12,000. So it seemed hugely expensive to introduce an official record of debates. It's a no-brainer to us now, but at the time, all of these other things, like can we please get mail service and a shipping line and rail, they just are obviously more, they're present and they're very pressing. And this is the this is a priority to keep the country together. So it just was one of those things that was kind of prioritized out until 1874 when they voted on a Canadian Hansard.
Why should Canadians really care about looking at these debates and seeing exactly what was said in the House of Commons or in the Senate at the time?
Well, partly I think they'll be surprised that some of the debate, you know, doesn't change that much. Some of these things are, you know, evergreen and perpetual, and these are some perennial favorites in the debates. I think it is going to lend character to some of the founding fathers of our country, that John A. Macdonald stood up and was, you know, emotional in the House. I think those sorts of things are great to give a clearer sense of history in terms of the people, not just what they did and those sort of names and dates and bill titles and that sort of thing, but to really flesh out these were the people and this is how they felt about these things and they were passionate about these things. So I think that's really important. I don't kid myself. I don't think that every person is going to, you know, run out right now and get themselves some reconstituted debates and sit down and read them. But they can do. I think everyone owes it to themselves to take a look because it is really compelling stuff. But more importantly, this stuff is put together and available now to those sorts of information gatekeepers. So teachers of history, students of history, people who, you know, research and write books about Canadian history. And I think that's where you're going to see the real value of the project.
And it's good to point out to our listeners that it's not just available here in the Library of Parliament, but they have many ways to access these debates.
That's right. So we've completed a digital portal of all debate content. So even after, once there was an official record, that wasn't digitally available before the end of last year. And we now have a consolidated portal. It's at parl.canadiana.ca. And we're now just filling the gap and putting in these last volumes into that portal so that every year from 1867 up until the mid-90s when the chamber started publishing directly online is available one place searchable in this single portal. So both chambers, both languages, everything that's available has been loaded in there and is available to search full text.
It's amazing. Thank you very much, Sonia. I really appreciate this opportunity.
It is my absolute pleasure.
That was Sonia Bebbington, the Director of Knowledge Management and Preservation with the Library of Parliament.
Coming up, former parliamentarians tell a Toronto think tank why Ottawa is broken and how it can be fixed.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
What is wrong with the House of Commons? It's a question I'm sure every Canadian has asked at one point or another in their lives, including members of Parliament. The Toronto think tank Samara has released a book called Tragedy in the Commons, which takes a look at the political process through the eyes of politicians.
The group conducted interviews with more than 80 former parliamentarians and explores the frustrations and successes of those MPs as they navigated through the world of federal politics. I was able to speak with Alison Lote, the co-founder of Samara and the co-author of this book. I guess, first of all, could you just sort of walk us through what you've done here in terms of these exit interviews with MPs and sort of where the idea came from to even take on this project?
Sure. About 4 or 5 or so years ago, my colleague Michael McMillan and I were just starting Samara, which has grown to be a little bit bigger than it was 5 years ago, but it's an organization dedicated to improving political participation, underpinned on the value of public service. And we were trying to figure out a bit of a thorny problem, which is why politics, public policy, things we viewed as being very important to the quality of life we have in Canada, were increasingly irrelevant to Canadians themselves. Common management wisdom always says if you are trying to figure out a difficult problem, you should go to the source. And so when we were thinking about that relationship between citizens and politics, we thought it would be interesting to talk to members of parliament, who of course are the people we elect to represent us to our government. We know that current MPs are very caught up in the to-ing and fro-ing of the day-to-day, and that's where we came up with the idea of doing exit interviews with former MPs, because exit interviews, as probably most of your listeners know, are very common in all kinds of organizations, public and private, but they've never been done in Parliament. And so we thought that would be a really interesting way to start a conversation about how our politics worked and, frankly, how they could work better for Canadians.
In terms of working better, the title of your book, Tragedy in the Commons, I guess, gives away the fact that the book suggests that things aren't going so well up here. What exactly did you find, and what are sort of the major problems?
Well, I've been asked many times over the course of working on this project, did anything surprise you that the MP said? And the one thing that I'd say surprised me the most is how very consistent the MP's answers were, particularly given that, you know, these were 80 men and women, all parts of the country, all political parties, you know, all walks of life, all backgrounds. And so there were a couple of themes that just came back over and over in terms of what, at least how they remembered their time in office. The first was how persistent there was a narrative of not being a politician, never wanting to be a politician, a sort of anti-outsider stance that they all had. So, for example, we would ask, you know, what we thought was a simple question: why did you plan to run? And, you know, how did you get into this? And they said, well, I never, ever planned to run. I was asked. I was, you know, one person said his neighbor came back every day for a week until he agreed to run. So the sense of being really cajoled in. And that persisted. So, I mean, that was one really dominant theme, which is just that the MPs almost are trying to separate themselves from their own species and therefore for the problems that they articulate. So that was that's part of the tragedy, of course, is that, you know, these very capable men and women are not willing to stand up and say, you know, I think politics is important and I wanted to take a shot. So that was one. And then the second, of course, was when we asked them why, if they weren't happy with how things were going, they didn't change. They pointed their finger in to what, to me anyway, was an unexpected direction, and that was their own political party, not the opposition, but their own party. And so, again, that sort of begs the question, if political parties aren't working for members of parliament, we guess we shouldn't be surprised that so few Canadians have joined them.
Oh, I mean, I think a lot of people look at politics in a rather negative light for all sorts of reasons, but do we almost underestimate what the actual experience is like for people going through it? You know, you in the book walk through sort of the nomination process and then, you know, showing up to Parliament Hill even after you've won the election and sort of not knowing what you're supposed to do, and then the kind of the frustration of being an MP in the House and in Parliament. You know, first of all, I think it's interesting that you've managed to get at sort of the very human experience of it. But do we underestimate sort of, you know, the fact that these are just human beings in a difficult, demanding job who, you know, see problems themselves?
I think we do. I don't think the Canadian, you know, the average Canadian gives a lot of thought to what life as a politician might be. And, you know, we all know the stereotypes of a politician, and we know, you know, that they're not trusted in the ways that they used to be and things like that. And that's, I hope, one of the contributions that this book makes is that we actually have taken the time to visit 80, you know, quite remarkable young men and women who come from all sorts of backgrounds and, as I said, all across the country, to talk to them about what it felt like to them. You know, why they decided to, you know, pick up their lives, which, you know, again, were sometimes, you know, hundreds of kilometers from Ottawa, and decide to take a shot at public service. So that, you know, that I think is one of the most interesting aspects of this. I mean, there are lots of personal moments in here. I mean, I remember sitting with one MP in rural Alberta, and I had asked children before some of the questions I was going to ask him, and he said, you know, I wrote a few words down here, and one of them was lonely. Because you are away from your family and friends, and you don't often appreciate that human side. And then, as you said, the system itself doesn't always make it the easiest workplace in the world. You know, the behavior, of course, of what we see on TV is very strange, and, you know, it's always odd. I and probably you and probably everybody tries to, you know, when they're in public, tries to act as best as they can and save their less savory aspects for private. But in politics, it seems to be the exact opposite, and I think a lot of people arrive and say, you know, whoa, what is this? So, yeah, I hope this does bring to light a little bit of really how strange a world it can be, and how it is experienced by the people, the human beings who do make up our representatives.
you also get at the conundrum of the situation, you know, the idea of the tragedy of the commons, where you have a shared resource and everyone trying to use it with short-term incentives, and that ends up sort of ruining the resource in the long term. So I guess, first of all, how do you see that applying specifically to MPs? You know, why can't they fix it? Why don't they fix it?
Yeah, well, we've borrowed the analogy from an essay that was written in the late 60s called Tragedy of the Commons, which is about how back in the old days when we had a common park in the center of town, in the center of the village, farmers would take their cows there, and everyone's, of course, incented to bring one more cow onto the field, and then, of course, the land is depleted for everybody. And we felt that was an apt analogy for what we were hearing from the members of Parliament, which is that they all felt that the long-term best interest of the country and of the health of our democracy was being sacrificed largely by partisan short-term political and electoral concerns. And when you try to think about what's going to ever break that, right? So, for example, let's even just think of small things like the use of statements in the House of Commons to degrade other people. Again, purely for a political game or to, you know, get a little speaking point out in the news. What's going to break that? And Jay Hill, who was the House leader for the Conservatives for many years, said it best. And he said, you know, the only way that's ever going to change is if members of Parliament stand up and say, I'm not doing that anymore. And that can be really tough in the face of difficult incentives to the contrary. But again, we do elect MPs and our politicians to uphold the quality of democracy that, you know, people all over the world fight to die for, and we have here. But it does get to the heart of the conundrum. And so in our last chapter, it's really an appeal from former political leaders to political leaders who are here today and are still to come, that we can do it better, and they should expect and demand more from each other and of themselves.
That was the co-founder of Samara, Allison Lote, speaking about her book Tragedy in the Commons, which examines the problems and benefits of our political system through the eyes of federal politicians. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.